Okay, good morning to everyone. We're going to start the class in approximately 5 minutes. We'll just do a brief audio check. Today we're going to continue with last week's theme of the temple, and specifically more into the topic of the specific vessels. And again, we will start in about 5 minutes, 4 minutes or so. Wait for friends to join us on the phone. Audio check, and once you hear the audio, just type in audio okay at the bottom of your screen. That gives us confirmation that you're picking up the audio stream properly. And if you do miss any part of the classes, the sessions that we broadcast here at Talk Live, you can hear them in their entirety by going to the audio link or to the new postings link, and we post it there briefly after the class is over. So this way, if you do miss any part of it, you will be able to listen to the entire class. And thank you, Rosora. I hope you get the message today, Rosora. So perhaps we'll talk about it after the class. Or you could actually use the, after we finish with the subject matter today, as I mentioned, you may want to just type the questions in on screen. Whatever is better for you, Rosora. And we will start just momentarily, just about a minute or so. Then again, we'll be taking up the topic that we commenced last week on the basic foundation principles of the temple, the whole purpose of the temple, since we just finished reading about it, and as we concluded the book of Exodus yesterday. Okay, Dee in Atlanta, thank you for the audio confirmation, and we'll just start momentarily.
Good morning, Rabbi. It's Doug Taylor.
Doug, how are you?
Excellent. How about yourself?
Good. How was your week?
Oh, good.
Yeah, we got our second winter storm here, and it wasn't really that bad of a storm, but it was the second time. The only time we get snow this year, was both of them were ice storms.
Yeah, I heard that there were some planes stranded on the tarmac for quite a while.
Really?
But I picked up the
I'm not surprised.
It was stranded for about 10 hours.
Again. I hope it wasn't JetBlue.
No, it wasn't. They canceled the majority of their flights.
They want to have a fiasco again.
Yeah.
Wow.
Sounded like the problem centered around availability of de-icing equipment.
Wow. Maybe they should heat up the de-icing equipment before they use it next time.
Yeah.
I think we got all the snow that you usually get.
Oh, you guys get snow this week?
No, well, not this week, but this season. We never have had snow like, well, since we've been here, we've never had this kind of snow that we've had this winter.
Wow. Well, there's global warming, another theory down the drain. All right, so we're going to pick up today from what we were doing last week. Okay, so we're discussing, last week we basically commenced discussing about the temple and the altar and the combination of the two. And we talked about how the sacrifice itself was something which Adam the First had initiated, and it was something which he did as soon as he was created, or pretty much right after, thereafter. And we stated the reason for that was his recognition that he didn't exist moments before his creation. And he was created with complete knowledge. He wasn't created as an infant. So he had full speech, full vocabulary, and full knowledge. Like Ibn Ezra says, he was a Chacham Gadol, a great intellect. So being a great intellect, he recognized right away that he is now creator, and that there is a God, there's a creator that made him. And he was completely overcome with appreciation and recognition that he is a creation. So what he did as a response, and how's the sound, by the way, today, Doug?
It's good, Rabbi.
Let me just get the phone. I can bring it a little closer here. Bring it over here. So the concept that Adam wanted to demonstrate with sacrifice is that he took something that was alive and he rendered it not existing anymore, meaning he killed it, he slaughtered it. He did it, and we do sacrifice, of course, in the painless way. We have to use a knife which is completely free of any nicks or any defects in the blade. So this way, it's virtually a painless activity for the animal. It's sort of like blacking out and maybe just feeling something light across your neck, because it's something which is very thin, very sharp. It's not something which is picked up by the nerves as much as a blunt instrument or something that's jagged. So there's very little surface area that you're dealing with, very little nerves that you're dealing with. So that's number one. But the reason he was rendering the animal dead was to mimic the state that he was in just moments before he was created. He wanted to demonstrate that just as this animal is dead, I really did not exist moments ago. And he wanted to recall that as being a primary lesson that he felt with his complete knowledge, with his great level of wisdom as being the perfect individual. God just created him. So with this undiluted intellect, and you know, completely pure from any type of influences, because there was no influences yet. This is the beginning of creation. So the perfect action of the perfect man, as soon as he's created, is to demonstrate that he realizes he's a creation. And the way you show that is by showing, you take an animal, because God evidently created Adam because he wanted him to be alive. So he couldn't take his own life. So what he did was, he recognized that the entire world is really for Adam. Everything else was set up on the world first. Adam was the last thing to be created. So he recognized that really God was setting the stage in order to invite the guests, so to speak. And the rabbis say this as well, in other words. So he wanted to demonstrate this concept that he really doesn't deserve to exist. And this is something which, for whatever, you know, purpose or objective, or we can't even say this in connection with God, because God doesn't have a human purpose or human objectives. He is not human, so he doesn't work that way. But what Adam wanted to at least demonstrate was that he knew that he didn't have a nature that has to exist. It's not important that he exists except for himself. So that was the primary lesson a man has to have in life, that I really don't have to be here. And we said another idea which proves this is that as soon as he was created, God gave him a command: don't eat from the tree, which teaches that Adam, or human beings, don't have a purpose in existence unless they have a relationship with their creator. And that's what a command means. A command means that there is an authority, God, and then there is one who is the servant, which is man. And this is demonstrated through God giving a command, meaning God has the right to command man. And man has the need to recognize that he's just not placed here to roam about the world free for the duration of his life. The fact that he has a command now teaches him that primary lesson, that now there's a relationship that he has to have with God. So not only is the first lesson something which Adam observed himself, that I didn't exist 2 seconds ago and now here I am. So he was completely appreciative that he had this now, he had existence and a faculty of intelligence to perceive the Creator and be awed by this knowledge. That really epitomizes the whole purpose of man. And he was completely overcome by thanks and appreciation. At the same time, it was still necessary that a command is given, so man now knows that not only do you have to be appreciative and recognize your mission, but now there's a relationship that you should try to sustain with the Creator, and that he is the authority and that you have a mission here. Okay, so those are two main ideas, and that's what sacrifice was. Sacrifice, like Doug, you had mentioned last week, we quoted the Rambam, Maimonides' statement, that he says that where King David and King Solomon offered sacrifices, that was the same place where Abraham sacrificed Isaac, and where Jacob had the vision of the ladder, and the same place where Cain and Abel and Noah offered sacrifices. When Noah came out of the ark, that's where he sacrificed, and Cain and Abel had sacrificed at this location, and that's the place where Adam sacrificed, and that is the location from which Adam was created, that parcel of ground. So we see that the inceptional significance of this location, of Mount Moriah, of where the Temple Mount is today, so that location has significance because that is, it goes all the way back in time. Everybody sacrificed there, but they all sacrificed there because they recognized how the importance originated at this location, and that was that man was created at this location. So sacrifice is a response throughout time, throughout all the thousands of years of man's history. Sacrifice always harkens back to that original inceptional moment where man was created from this location and then offered a sacrifice. So that concept is so central and fundamental to life that you see that sacrifice was carried on even before there was a temple. That was something which was always essential to men. So sacrifice is synonymous with recognition that we are created, and that was one of the fundamentals we talked about last week. And temple, we see the altar was lined up directly with the opening of the temple. And the temple is now the location which now underlined that that place. And we said also the Maimonides statement that once the temple was built in Jerusalem, it was not allowed to be built anywhere else anymore. Before that, it had different locations. But once they arrived in Jerusalem and Mount Moriah, and they made it where that original place was, where Adam was created, now it was not allowed to be created anywhere else anymore because it now added that significance of the location. So the sacrifice by itself is a recognition that we should not really exist. There's no real reason why man has to exist. God does not benefit. So sacrifice is the act where we take life and we render it non-existent to mirror the true state of man, that he really does not exist. We didn't exist except for a few thousand years. So that's the concept of sacrifice. But then when we team it with the original place that Adam was created, it underlines that idea as well. Okay. Was there anything else that we discussed last week? I just wanted to give a little synopsis before we started. Yeah. Okay. All right. So now, and we also mentioned the idea that temple was actually a response, according to Sforno. Temple is a response to the sin of the golden calf. And the way it's a response is that we stated again that when the Jews miscounted and thought that Moses should have descended already from Sinai, they started counting too early, and they now felt that the 40 days was complete, that Moses said he would return, and he wasn't there. So the people panicked, they worried, and they approached Aaron and said, make for us gods that will go before us. And they said, these are the gods of Israel. And what Rashi says is that they didn't say, because the words in the Torah say, these are your gods. So why would the Jews say these are your gods if they're trying to make it for themselves? They just say, this is our God. They think Moses is gone. They said, Moses, the man that took us out of Egypt. We said that was very significant. Of course, Moses is a man. But what they said, Moses, the man that took us out of Egypt, because it expressed their problem. They were over-attached to the human quality of Moses, the physical nature. And it shows that they could not be without some sort of a physical guide. That's why they hurried and they made something new, physical, that would replace Moses. And Ramban, Nachmanides, says that no fool would say that the gold that they took out of the ears, because that's how they made the gold calf, they took all the gold from the women and the children. That was Aaron's plan. He was hoping that he would delay their creation of this idol. And in the meantime, Moses would come down. But they were so fast to pluck the gold out of their nose and their ears that they fashioned the gold calf quickly, even before Moses descended. So Aaron's plan was unfortunately a failure. The Jews made the gold calf, and but then Rashi says that, what does it mean that the people said, these are your gods, Israel? What Rashi's saying is that the mixed multitude, the Egyptians that joined the Jews, because the Jews didn't just leave themselves, but some Egyptians came with them. So about 3,000, I would assume they were all Egyptians, now were the ones that instigated the gold calf, because they were really the ones that had a stronger attachment. That was their culture from day one. And they're the ones that initiated the whole gold calf. And then when they made it, they said to the Jews, this is your God that took you out of Mitzrayim. And it was an interesting thing I just read over the weekend. Rabbi Fox had written a beautiful article on why God took the Jews out in this month of Nisan, the Hebrew month of Nisan, which correlates to the month where the Egyptians felt that their god Ammon was, I think, Aries, or some sort of a goat or a sheep-related god, and the Egyptians felt that in that month that god is supremely powerful. I guess they had a god for every month, and when that, the gods existed throughout the year, but when each god's relative month came around the calendar again, they were even more invincible according to their own views. So God wanted to show that your whole theory is wrong, and I'll even take the Jews out in the month that you think the calf is most invincible, the ram is most invincible. I'm going to take them out in that month to show you that belief is completely corrupt. But you see that so that's why he took them out in this month, because this is when the Egyptians thought they would be invincible against the Jews. And even then, they had no defense. The Jews left, they killed their god, they held it for 4 days and slaughtered it and offered it as the Paschal lamb in Egypt. And then they left. But evidently those Egyptians that attached themselves to the Jews upon the Exodus were the ones that instigated they didn't abandon the belief in their god. That's why they created a gold calf. They were going back to that very same attachment. But you see, it was attachment to the physical. And that was something which the Jews seemed to be unable to let hold of. They could not detach themselves. So that's why Sforno says that the temple is now a response, meaning temple, which is to be used as man's approach to God, will now aim at taking that need to have physical worship, but redirecting it in a manner that is correct. What the Jews expressed at Sinai was completely undirected emotion. Just they were completely haphazard and fully emotionally full of emotional expression, no direction, no intellectual involvement whatsoever, and this is what the result was. So evidently Sforno is teaching us that there is a need for physical expression, and we do see that because sacrifice did exist throughout time, even from day one. So, but God's goal evidently was to give them a Torah, and they would try to raise themselves above any type of additional need for objects. But we see the Jews couldn't do that, not at this juncture anyway. And this will be something which it's a fixture, it's part of the Torah system. So now this will never leave. But it will, so it definitely harkens back to the sin, but it's a response to the sin, according to Sforno, in order to take man's emotions that he desires religious worship, but to direct them properly. And that's what we want to do today, is try to understand how and what is this temple doing in terms of this objective, according to Sforno. Okay, let me pause here, see if there's any questions or comments at this point.
Good ear, thank you.
Okay. And if anybody that's joining us on the internet has any questions, just type them on screen. Okay. So that gives us the backdrop for what we're going to discuss today. Now, it's important that, as we commence, that we understand what the primary objects were in the temple and what the structure of the temple was. Now, we know on the outside of the temple, there was the altar. That's what we discussed last week, which is where they offered up the animal sacrifices. The temple itself, though, was a one building, and it had two rooms. As you walked in, which is where the priests were allowed to enter throughout the year, was the called the holiest, a lower level of sanctity. And as you walked in, right in the middle of that room, dead center was the incense altar. Further in front of you, and against the curtain, you saw a dividing curtain at the end of that room, directly in front of you. So if you're walking in from the east and you're looking westward, you would be walking into the eastern opening. You would see the incense altar in front of you. It was a rectangular space, so it was longer than it was wide. And even further in, so after you'd walk past the incense altar, you'd see on the left-hand corner of that room the candelabra. And then on the right-hand corner against the curtain, you would see the table with the showbread. And they were right up against the curtain. I think about an arm's breadth away from the dividing curtain called the Parochus. The Parochus was a dividing curtain between that room, the Holies, and then there was a Holy of Holies, which housed the Ark of the Covenant. And inside the Ark, we know the two tablets of sapphire stone that were the Ten Commandments. And on top of the Ark was the covering of the two gold Keruvim, the cherubs, the childlike figurines with wings that were covering the Ark. So that was what was in that room. There were a few other items, but we'll get into that in a moment. But primarily that Holy of Holies, you were never allowed to walk into. And if you did, there was a penalty of death. And we see Aaron's two sons did walk in to offer up a sacrifice that they were not commanded, and they were killed immediately. So we have to understand why the punishment of so severe. All they're doing is they're walking into the room. So why are they punished? So again, we have, as you walk into the temple, you had three items. The incense altar in front of you. And as you keep walking, on your left-hand side, you would see the menorah, the candelabra. And the right-hand side, you would see the table that had the 12 loaves of the showbread. Those are the only three items that you had in this room, the holies. You had the separating curtain. And behind that curtain, you had the ark, the golden ark, with the cherubim on top. Okay? So we have to understand, what are these four objects? What is the nature also of the room is that you could only enter, the priests were only allowed to enter into the holies, but they cannot go into the Holy of Holies. That was only a one day a year, that was Yom Kippur. And what happened on that one day of Yom Kippur? The high priest, Aaron, would take incense in a pan, he would go into the Holy of Holies and smoke it up and place it down right in front of the ark and cause the whole room to smoke. And then once it would smoke up, he would leave. And later on in the day, he would come back and then remove the pan that had the burnt out incense. And that was it. Only twice a year that he would go in, once to place it and once to remove it. And the whole purpose of that service was to smoke up the room. So what's that idea? It seems like a very odd type of a service. Okay.
Hello?
Yes.
One question about the temple. Is there any indication that when the temple was constructed that there was any divine intervention that was went along with the building of the temple? Because what I'm wondering is in the Holy of Holies, if you're not allowed to go in it, then how was it created, and how were these things put together?
The construction had to be, Moses did the construction. But evidently to create the whole assemblage that you have to say was necessary. There was no prohibition in terms of that. In order to create the room, that has to be done by men. There was some divine miracle that took place by the temple. Subsequent to its construction. So that is true in terms of your first question. But the rooms have to be created, and Moses is the one that put it together. Okay. Now, let's take a look at the vessels. And we should also note that when Moses heard God's voice, whenever he would commune with God, he heard it coming, according to Rashi, emanating from the between the two cherubs in the Holy of Holies. So that's significant. But let's come back to that. And again, but keep in mind that that was a room that was off limits. Now let's look at the design of the other vessels and see if we can arrive at some basic working knowledge as to what the objective is of these vessels. The incense altar was pretty much a rectangular box-like shape, and on it, man would offer up incense. It was a form of sacrifice. The menorah was an item that had seven branches, and the table that had 12 loaves of bread on it. Now, is there anything that we could say about these initial designs?
Rabbi?
Yes.
It's like the numbers are significant, like the menorah having the seven branches would represent the 7 days that had to do with 6 days of creation and then the seventh day for Shabbat.
Right.
And then the 12 loaves representing the 12 tribes.
That's correct, 12 tribes. And what would loaves represent?
Sustenance.
Right, sustenance. Okay. And sacrifice was something which we know always happened. Man would offer up. So, what's essential to sacrifice making sense?
Rabbi?
Yes, sir.
When you said that man would offer up incense in the form of sacrifice on the altar.
I'm saying it's my suggestion that it's a form of approaching God.
Well, there wasn't any animal sacrifice on that altar. It was just incense.
That's right.
Yeah, thank you.
That's right. See, you basically have two good points there, Cal. One is that you have a concept of creation, that the menorah has seven branches. And it is interesting that the design of it is that there are six branches, three on each side, that emanate from a central seventh branch. So the seventh branch has great significance. So that even follows more the concept of creation. Another unique feature of the menorah is that it had to be created not piecemeal, but it had to be banged out of one block of gold. Interesting phenomenon. And that same law applied to the cherubs. They couldn't be two separate cherubs that were made separately and then joined to the covering of the ark. The cover and the two cherubs together was banged out of one block of gold. Now, again, we have to keep in mind this whole time that, according to Sforno, the temple is a response to man's need for religious expression, but in a way which directs him to the correct ideas. So let me now again, there's the idea that man cannot go in to this room. What does that represent to you? That man cannot go in to the Holy of Holies. And if he does, he's killed. And again, this is where Moses heard the voice of God emanating from.
Rabbi, would that harken back to the idea that a man cannot look at God and live?
Yes, exactly. That definitely does. Meaning, if this is where God's causing his voice to emanate from, as I mentioned, D in Atlanta, I'm not sure what you're writing. You're saying that all suggests that everything is connected. I'm not really sure what you mean over there, D. But yeah, Doug, you're correct. That the concept over here of the Holy of Holies is, and that's the primary focal point of the temple. And what's very interesting is that the temple itself had, it had no roof. It had walls, but no roof. To me, that indicates that it shows you it's not a place for dwelling, But the place is sort of, it's more like a museum. A museum is not a place for dwelling. It's a place just so you have a location that you can now see the contents. So if you have a location that has no roof, therefore it's not the location that's important. It's what is inside that's important. So I think that's just a side point, but it points you to that. The actual one, now if you were inside the holies and you looked up, what you would see is one of the curtains. There were three levels of curtains. The curtain that you would see had images of the cherubim, the cherubs, on it, indicating again that the objective, even of this outer room, is to focus on the cherubs. And if you would look at the dividing curtain from that outer room, which had the menorah, you know, on the table, if you look towards that curtain, you would see two bulges in that curtain, that dividing curtain. Those two bulges were purposeful, and they were the ends of the two staves that they carried the ark with, and they always stayed in the ark. The ark had was different than all other vessels that they carried, in that once Moses set up the temple and he carried all the vessels in, you know, with their carrying rods, so that he'd slide out the rods and remove them from the temple. Or he would just slide them out. There was no need for the rod to be in there. But that was not the case with the ark. The ark, there was a law that you could never remove the poles from the ark, which is interesting. Why is that? But again, when you're inside the temple, what you would see is everything focusing on. That's why when you looked at the dividing curtain, it was important that you weren't completely oblivious to what was behind it. So there had to be, the poles had to push the curtain up a little bit to create like two bulges. So this way you see a hint of the ark. And if you looked up, you saw the cherubim. So you see that the cherubim, that was really the whole focus of the room. The reason being, and I think this is one of the central ideas of the temple, is to tell you one idea. What do you think that idea is, Doug? You were just mentioning it.
That you can't approach God, that you can't...
Right, exactly. You cannot approach God. We cannot have any concept of God in this life. That has to be the most primary, because that was really where the Jews made the sin with the golden calf. So that's how temple comes as a response. The primary error was that they were attached to Moses. They said Moses, the man who took us out of Egypt, is gone. We don't know what happened to him. They went ahead and participated in the golden calf, meaning they needed some tangible thing that they can relate to. And this was something which, on the one hand, showed a need for expression of religiosity. On the other hand, it demonstrated that they couldn't abstract themselves. So that's what God tried to do now with the temple, is to create a location, that the objective of this location is to teach the concept that you cannot know God. Man cannot lo yirani ad v'chai. The Torah says that when Moses asked God, a few weeks ago we read in the Torah, to know, Moses wanted to know God's true nature. So God says, you can't understand me when you're alive. And that's talking about Moses, the greatest intellect. Certainly that applies to everybody else. So this is a central idea. That's the first idea. So that room cannot be approached in order to teach this idea. And if a person did go into that room and denied that concept, so then his life was meaningless at that point. That's why the two sons of Aaron were killed. And the same thing, I think we mentioned last week, that when the Philistines returned the ark, so it went back to the Jews in a certain town, and the Jews looked into the ark as if there's something to see in connection with God, and God killed 57,000 Jews. And there's an argument as to what they were. I think the 57 Jews that were like, each one was great, and they were like 1,000 Jews each. So whatever teaching is, but a lot of Jews died because they looked into the ark. So we see it's very important the person never oversteps that bounds.
Rabbi?
Yes?
You mentioned that the ark had no roof.
The temple had no roof.
The temple had no roof. But they had those blue processed hides or skins or whatever that were laid over as a cloth roof. Is that the way it worked?
Yeah, there was a woven roof covering, and then there was another, I think, goat skin covering on top of that, and then there was like an animal skin covering on top of that. And actually, Rabbi Fox has a piece on that. Let me just see.
So when you say no roof, you're talking about no hard constructed roof.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Right. Actually, it was in the... I reprinted it. Let me see where it is. Right. I reprinted it this week in the Jewish Times. It's the cover on the weekly Parsha by Yakel.
Okay.
So it was a very nice article that Rabbi Fox wrote.
Does anyone address the question of how they were able to see inside the temple?
Well, the tabernacle, which was the temple in the wilderness, no, there were solid walls. You couldn't see inside unless you walked in. But
I guess I'm getting at the issue of how they lit it from inside.
Well, you had the menorah. The menorah was lit inside there.
Okay.
But in Solomon's temple, you had windows.
Okay.
All right, so now we see that this, you know, the central idea that we have to recognize that we are ignorant about what God is. We just have no concept. But if that's true, then that's the room that you cannot go into. And not going into the room demonstrates an inability to approach God in this respect. So what does it mean that they were allowed to go into the first room that had the candelabrum in the menorah, the table with the showbread, and the incense altar? That would seem to imply what concept? If they could go into there, what would that imply?
There is perhaps a certain amount of limited knowledge that a man can, or a person can grasp about the Creator?
Yes, exactly. Right. That would naturally follow. Now what we're going to do is to go back to what your wife had mentioned before and show what are those things that we can know. And I just want to mention that when we say the prayers on the high holidays, the two main concepts that we talk about in terms of praising God's, you know, ultimate kingship as much as we humanly can, we talk about God being omnipotent and omniscient, that God is all-powerful and he's all-knowing. And pretty much under those two headings, everything else would fall under. The fact that God created the universe is omnipotence. That he does miracles, that's omnipotence. He's all-powerful. There's nothing that limits his power. And the fact that God gives man reward and punishment, that shows that God is all-knowing. He's omniscient. So if we subsume all that we know into the two greatest categories, so we see that the rabbi's formulation of the high holiday prayers are addressing those two things. When we're talking about we're recognizing God as being the king and being the ruler, the owner, the creator of the universe. So we talk about his omniscience and his omnipotence. And another concept is that daily when we pray to God each day, the first real prayer that we start with after the introductory prayers, but the first main prayer, as Rabbi Chait explained, is called Baruch Shamar, which says, "Blessed is the one who spoke and the world came into being." So the first thing we have to say in the morning, each morning, when we're rising up from that instinctual state of sleep, and this is why I believe the morning prayers are about a half an hour, whereas the afternoon and evening prayers are only about 5-10 minutes each. But the morning, there's much more that you have to now fight against. The emotions have such a grip since we were in a state of sleep for 8 hours. Or hopefully we had 8 hours sleep. Some of us don't have that luxury, but the instincts have such a grip on us that when we wake up, we have to now remove ourselves from that state. So more prayer is required. But the primary thing that we say to commence our prayers is that we first say, blessed is the one who spoke and the world came into being. Why do we start the prayers with that statement? Why must that be the initiation of our prayers? Blessed is the one who spoke and the world came into existence.
Is that to remind us of the really going back to Adam and the creation, that you know, there is a creator, there is an authority, and that we are created?
That's true. But now that we are praying, in the context of prayer each morning, why does that have to start it out?
Because without the Creator, we wouldn't exist. The fact that He chose to create man.
That's true. Why does that have to commence prayer, though? That's commencing about a half an hour more of prayers that we're going to be involved in. Why must that commence the prayers?
It was the beginning. It was acknowledging the very beginning.
We don't. Let me put it this way. We don't remind ourselves that God created the world before we sit down to a meal. We don't remind ourselves that God's a creator before we attend a dinner, or I'm trying to think of something else that would be a... I mean, it's specific to prayer for a reason. What are we doing with prayer? What are we doing with the prayers?
We're reciting correct ideas about the Creator.
Right.
So it would seem like the foundational idea is that we came into existence and are here and able to do this prayer only because He spoke.
Right. Right, that's true. That would be appropriate in terms of, like, for example, when Adam was created. So he now is recalling that. I'm only here able to do this. But according to what you're saying, I should do that, I should make that statement before I do any command. I mean, it does permeate a lot of areas. I mean, we eat a fruit, we do say that God created this. But here specifically, I believe the reason why we're saying it is because prayer is where you're now giving praise, you are now addressing God. It's a different type of activity than the other activities. Whereas when you put on tefillin, you're not addressing God, you're now putting something on your body to recognize a certain idea. When we wear tzitzis, it's to recall the command to put them on and to keep something in our focal point, so this way if we're about to sin, we look at the tzitzis and we remind ourselves of all the commands. But prayer is a dialogue, if we have to define. We are now addressing God. So what is so essential to a dialogue is that you know who you're talking to. That's why you first define who I'm praying to right now is the one who spoke and the world came into being. That's why that must be the commencement of my prayer. Because since prayer is where you're now giving praise to what you understand as being God, you first have to reiterate and clarify which God you're relating to, because human fantasy could lead you to create a golden calf. And a person has to be on guard for this every single day. We don't lose that part of ourselves that those Jews, that caused those Jews to make a golden calf. We just have to make sure that we're constantly learning more and refining our ideas. But there's always that danger, and especially when we're coming out of a sleep state. So the rabbis formulated that what you should really start your prayers with, since you're now involved in a dialogue, now, and since you're involved in relating to God, that's your action. It's not an involvement of, let's say, you know, shechita, where you slaughter an animal. So that is not a dialogue framework. Or if I am now doing giving charity, I'm not involved in a dialogue with God. There's so many areas of Torah. But only in prayer is where, or in temple worship, is there this phenomena where now you are approaching God. You are addressing him. You see the difference between prayer and everything else?
Yes.
Okay, now due to that difference, it's important that, and like D is from Atlanta saying, yes, we speak during prayer, but speak means that we, there's a recipient to our speech. So again, it just shows that it's a dialogue. So we see now, in terms of when we talk about God's greatness, and we have the right concept of God, meaning we can't go into the Holy of Holies because we have to demonstrate that we can't approach God directly in this existence. We can't know what God is. And we demonstrate that by restraining ourselves from going into that area. We are not approaching him directly. And Moses did the same thing at the burning bush, that he turned away. And that was something he was rewarded for. Because he saw in that vision that he could only go so far. And he didn't try to look with his mind any further. And that was a good measure that he took. So we're saying that that's the Holy of Holies. That's where God causes his voice to emanate from. That's where we have to demonstrate we can't approach God. We don't know what he is. But the holies, where you have the candelabrum and the showbread, and you have the incense altar, that's a room that we can go into. And like you said, Doug, this must be here to indicate something that we can know in connection with God. And I think the three ideas that we just mentioned, that God is omniscient, he's omnipotent, and that who are we relating to? The God of creation. That's what I believe this room is here for. Meaning when the priests walk in, they see the candelabrum on the left. They're defining, they recognize again, we are relating here in this temple to the God who created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. So we have a candelabrum with six branches and a seventh center branch. So we have that concept, just like we have it every morning. And then that's in terms of defining which God. Not to say that there's any other, but because people have false notions of God. Is he physical? Is he not? We have to constantly, every day, we must reiterate the concept that the God that we are relating to is the God of creation. That is the best definition we can give. But not only do we define him that way, but we now can know certain things. And that is, like we say in the prayers on the High Holidays, he is all-powerful and he's all-knowing. And that's exactly what the table does. A table that has 12 loaves of bread, that demonstrates what concept? That it can provide for all 12 tribes. The bread is put on the table always, and it's never to be removed, to demonstrate the concept that God is omnipotent. And the incense altar, the concept of a person praying or offering up something to God only makes sense if God recognizes man's actions. So the concept of an altar is only sensible if we know that God recognizes us, if he's omniscient. So that's what the altar does. So it ends up that in this room, you have the basic categories, the basic fundamentals in terms of what we can know in terms of God. What can we know? The menorah tells us, has seven branches, that's creation. That the God we relate to is the God of creation. That's the menorah. And we also know that he is all-powerful. That's the table, the showbread. That means he can sustain his creations afterwards, because the menorah definitely teaches that he's all-powerful. He made creation. But the table with the showbread now shows that throughout creation, all generations of Jews represented by 12 loaves, the 12 tribes, that shows that throughout time he's omnipotent and he can sustain and he's involved on a regular basis. So the concept that he's involved and he's all-powerful also shows that he's gives providence. So all-powerful means providence as well. And the incense now shows that not only is he all-powerful, but he's all-knowing. Because the concept of offering up something to God cannot make sense unless he is omniscient. So now we see how the temple responds to the unbridled, idolatrous emotion that the Jews expressed by the golden calf. God now formulates a building, a structure, very precisely that targets what we can know and what we can't know. Okay, so let's pause here for a second, see if there's any questions or comments.
Rabbi, can I ask a question?
Yes, go ahead. Who's that?
This is Bill.
Hey, Bill, how are you?
How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Just joined about half an hour ago. The Jewish understanding of the idea of getting up and praying in the morning, is there a sense in which when one comes out of sleep, I know there's certain Kabbalistic ideas that say that person's as close to death as they possibly can be, and so when one rises, it's like coming into like a resurrection. So when one rises in the morning, the idea of prayer is to make connection with the Holy One.
No, you're saying an idea which is true, it just has to be formulated well, and that is that one of the things we do say is that the first thing we say as soon as we open our eyes is we say, I am thankful before you, the King who is alive and always exists, that you return my soul to me, and great are your mercies. So that's what we say as soon as we open our eyes, that we recognize God, we thank him for the fact that he returned us to a conscious state. So that we can say. And upon doing that, I mean, you're also correct as well, that you are initiating your day by, establishing a new relationship with God. You're addressing him. You're recognizing him. You're not letting that precious moment go.
So as a follow-up to that, the benefits of doing formal prayer as opposed to extemporaneous prayer really is it kind of guards a person against the danger of the golden calf idea, correct? The person gets up and just begins to pray and to praise Hashem, and he does it extemporaneously as opposed to, you know, the other way of doing it formally. Is that kind of a guide to keep someone from wandering into the areas of the golden calf and idolatry, correct?
Yeah, certainly. There's numerous benefits, but for sure what you're saying is correct.
Okay.
To have it fixed. I mean, we borrow the fixed times of prayer from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham established morning prayer. Isaac had established afternoon prayer before sunset, and Jacob had established evening prayer. And it's interesting that it's aligned with certain parts of the day. The Talmud even says that a person should pray in the morning with sunrise and in the afternoon with sunset. And the concept, again, why sunrise and sunset? I'll let you think about that for a minute.
I'm sorry, ask the question?
Yeah, the question is, why is it that the Talmud states that a person should align the time of his morning prayers with sunrise and the time of his afternoon prayers with sunset? What is the targeted goal?
Good question. I can't answer it.
Well, think about what exactly sunrise and sunset is.
Well, it's the beginning of the day and it's the end of the day.
Well, that you can have without sunrise and sunset, can't you? You could have a beginning of the day, the end of the day without the actual... You could have a cloudy day. You still have a beginning and end without sunrise and sunset, right? I'm talking about the viewable phenomena.
I'm not sure.
All right, well, the phenomena of sunrise is a very... It calls back to creation, at these laws. And it's a... That's a noticeable change, as opposed to the sun just going through the sky throughout the day. That's not a real noticeable change. But it's dark, and then it becomes light, and you see the fiery sun ball rising above the horizon. That's an amazing view, and sunset as well. So to align our prayers with that shows that what we're trying to do is, like you mentioned, that we want to be on guard, that we have the right concept of prayer, that we're relating to the Creator. So we align it with some evidence of creation. And this is
right, so in a sense, we are, you know, that keeps us from making the same mistake that Nadab and Abihu made when they brought in something that Hashem did not ask them to bring in, and they were struck down. So that notion of understanding who he is and his omnipotence guards against that sort of thing and puts us into contact with the Creator.
That's correct.
Correctly.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, of course, what Nadav and Abihu had done is they assumed a practice. They did what, you know, God says in his Torah, don't add and don't subtract to the Torah. The reason is very clear. God knows exactly what he created. meaning he knows the human being, he knows the psyche, he knows the emotions, he knows the soul, and he knows the exact prescription that is going to make us happy. And that's why there's only 613 commands, no more, no less. A person is then told in the Torah, don't add and don't subtract. Why does God have to say don't add? Evidently, he knows very well that there's something called an over-religious emotion. Somebody wants to say, oh, I can do more, I want to do more. That's really a denial of God's, you know, 100% accurate knowledge of the human being. A person says he wants to do more, but God doesn't know what you need. If the doctor tells you to take 10 pills, no more, no less, I guarantee you nobody's going to deviate. Because when it comes to a physical life, a person doesn't want to jeopardize his health. So he's not going to say, oh, I'll do even more pills. Because you know, he can overdose. When it comes to the religious realm, that is something which people are not as clear on. And the emotion of being more religious is something which can overtake them. And we see
concern. This is why in the performance of the mitzvahs it becomes so important to do the mitzvahs, you know, with a certain exactness.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
I know that, yeah. That makes so much sense.
Right. This way it really restricts you to knowing that there's a very specific form. That's the whole structure of the temples for the same reason. And that's what since this is the area, I remember Rabbi Chait had once given a class, and they was talking about a Talmudic section, and that Talmudic section was saying it was a metaphor. He said that they wanted to try to restrain the instincts. So, the instincts came out of the Holy of Holies of the temple as a fiery lion. And that Talmudic section goes on, and it says that they tried to restrain it, they grabbed it by its mane, and it let out a roar, and they put it in a lead box. It's a metaphor. But Rabbi Chait had mentioned, what is the most significant part of that whole Talmudic section? He said that is that the instincts were seen coming out of the Holy of Holies, which means that the instincts of man have the greatest intensity when it comes to religious expression and a connection with God. So coming out of the Holy of Holies means to say that that's, and they're like a fiery lion, it's like an unbridled, strong, you know, powerful, passionate type of a phenomenon when it's in connection with the religious. So therefore the temple is so highly defined in every single way. You have to carry the animal, and you how you slaughter it, and the way you sprinkle the blood, and so there's no room for any type of a subjective emotional expression. So that type of a highly defined design, and maybe that's why it answers my own question I had this week, like why is the Torah take up so much real estate on the structure of the temple? You don't see this sections and sections on the temple that you don't find in connection with anything else in the Torah. Maybe the answer is this very reason, that since this is the area that human emotion is going to seek to be more expressive and unrestrained and not follow the guidelines, so therefore the Torah now has to respond to that and be very clear in every single word, and where do you place this, and how tall was this altar, and how long was this table, and the shape of the curtains, and so on and so forth. Exactly this point, that you have to really, they have to be bridled. We have to bridle the emotions, especially in this area of religious expression. This is where the dangers really are. So yes, and you know, being very exact that's the whole halachic system. That's, you know, that's how Judaism has survived all this time, is because of that very phenomena of having laws, precise laws, and then guards that the rabbis set up. And people complain, oh, you know, the rabbis, they make so many restrictions. And the truth is, you wouldn't have Judaism today if you didn't have the the rabbis foreseeing what was necessary to, and God sanctioned the rabbis. It says in Deuteronomy that he says, in accordance with the Torah that they teach you, you should follow. So God endorses the rabbis to set up guards to the 613. They can't go further than that. The rabbis themselves have limits. But, yeah, I mean, it's a very, you know, it has to be a very structured system for that goal. And this keeps our thoughts properly. It keeps our thoughts refined.
So it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And the ideas are beautiful too. Like when you finally see the purpose of the temple and the design and these different elements, it's like so all over the place. What are all these things for? But once you start seeing that there's a theme, And we see it's mirroring the concepts that we talk about on the high holidays when we're talking about what we can praise God. So therefore, that's what temple is for, to give us the right relationship to God. How do we get the right relationship to God? We have to have the true concepts of God, and we have to negate anything which is false. And the biggest thing we must negate is that we have no knowledge of God whatsoever, so we can't approach Him directly. So we have to have something in temple which is primary, and that is the Holy of Holies. That's why it's called the most sanctified room, because that's the most sanctified concept. We can't go in there. And that's why the law is in that room. That's why the Ten Commandments are housed in that room, to show that God's knowledge is not something which we could really... We're just going to scratch the surface in our lifetime. It's an amazing amount that we can get, but that amazing amount is really a drop in all the oceans of the earth. But we still have to have the... Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question. How do we know when it's correct to put up additional boundaries, and when you're going over the line and adding to, and I may be remembering this incorrectly, but didn't Adam add to, put up a boundary for Eve as far as don't even touch the tree?
Yeah, that was Eve.
And told him that, and then when she touched the tree and nothing happened, that kind of led the spiral towards those problems.
Yes, you're quoting Rashi. Rashi says, Kol Hamosif Gorea. Anybody who adds on actually detracts. So Eve was the one. As far as I recall, it was Eve who told the snake that we can't... eat it, and we can't touch this fruit. So she added on. So then the snake bumped her into the fruit to show her, look, nothing happened when you touched it. So then she said, wow, nothing happens when I touched it, so there's probably nothing going to happen when I eat it either. Right, so that is true. A person who adds on incorrectly, then they're going to detract from the system. That's the command. Don't add and don't subtract to the Torah. But your question that you started with, how do we know when we can add? I'll give you just one example. Regarding this previous holiday of Purim, the rabbis were reluctant to establish it as a holiday until they found a source in the Torah. So that means the Torah is the written five books of Moses is the strict guideline by which the rabbis, through they have 13 methods of derivation, and through them they can now set up rabbinical laws. But it has to be rooted in something in the verses. So there are very strict guidelines. And they did not set up the holiday of Purim until they found a source in the written Torah. And we also have, keep in mind, we have God's guarantee through the prophets that the Torah will never leave the Jewish people. And he does this because this way, this is the whole goal of giving it, is that it shouldn't be lost. So evidently we need divine providence to assist us in the retention of the original Torah. So that's something which we should find, much comfort in, that what we have today is what God gave, and it's not a corrupted system. Okay. Any other questions? All right.
Not on that. Thank you.
Okay. Should I deduce from something from what you just said?
Go ahead.
You said not on that.
Well, when you were talking about not adding and the emotionalism, we had it on mute, and I commented to my wife how in some churches, in Christian churches, they have speaking in tongues and the emotionalism, and it's just something that I always felt that it could lead to manipulation of people and corruption, and that really put it into a light where I could understand how that happened, is because of the emotionalism that's involved with religion and people's need and desire for that. And I've always been very suspect of of religious people who use that as a tool to take advantage of that need and that desire.
What exactly do they do when they speak in tongues? Because I never knew how to speak without a tongue.
Well, it is. I've only been at one service where they do that, and if you hear the people, it sounds like they're just babbling, and they believe that it is an unadulterated connection between a person and God, and that God's speaking through them. The only problem is that they don't always understand what they're saying, and the people around them don't always understand what they're saying, and then somebody's supposed to come in and interpret it. And it's something that I don't totally understand, but in a lot of these churches that are, especially some of the strong evangelical Christian churches, there's just this rampant emotionalism. And a lot of them have the speaking in tongues, and it's an incredible emotional high that these people have, and there's no discussing rationally anything with religion, because they just have this emotional high that they're living on that has no foundation on any intellectual concept. It's just this emotional high.
I guarantee if you go to any one of these people and you tell them to speak in tongues about what to inject into their vein and let them do it, and then take a syringe and don't tell them what's in the syringe and say, okay, I just interpreted that this is what, you know, God wants me to now inject in your body, well, I guarantee you 0% will accept that injection.
Thank you. Yeah. I'll have to remember that.
Yeah, but let's see how accurate they think that dead God is talking. It's amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's a funny thing. Judaism has it as well. As long as it's a safe thing and like nothing is really, you know, they can't see any tangible type of measure of help or not. Like they have a thing in Judaism where I see these things on these groups where they have these practices they just make up, and it's nothing to do with Judaism, and they think it has some effect. I take a key and I bake it in a piece of bread, and this is now going to I'm barren, I can't have children, and now this is going to somehow impregnate me. I mean, it's sounds just like Jesus. But this is since they're now taking a loaf of bread, which is called the challah, that they make for Shabbos, or they check the mezuzah, and mezuzah is one of the 613 commands. You have to have a mezuzah on your house. All right, and this is something which Jew and Gentile can fulfill equally. And it has a great idea. It reminds you that God is really the one that's giving you security in your house. It's not you. So it's a very good concept. But when people get sick in the house, they all of a sudden run to the mezuzah and check it, and they think if some letter is missing and this and that, therefore God is punishing them, which is ridiculous. But they look at for these physical type of things that, supposed to be guarding them, because that's the idolatrous emotion is looking for tangibility. It goes all back, and that's why it says, it says in the rabbis say that there's no sin that God visits upon the Jews that doesn't have some of the punishment of the golden calf. What does that mean? There's no sin that God visits upon the Jews that doesn't have some punishment for the golden calf. Seems like it's saying that every sin really partakes of a certain germ, the same germ of what the golden calf is. And that is giving in to the idolatrous emotions. In some way or another, a person is giving it a certain idolatrous type of thing, a tangibility. And therefore, when it says that all the sins in the future that God punishes, he punishes a bit of the golden calf, meaning that the sins that we do in the future are also sharing that same root idolatrous emotion. That's what they're trying to say. They're trying to equate the sins in the future. And we see, clearly, I went to some party on Purim, and the rabbi of the temple over there is giving out gold coins and saying this is somehow going to be protective. Complete idolatry. This is a rabbi. So there's no, the human being is not immune, and if he's not following the system, then he's going to go crazy. He's just in his emotions.
Can I ask a question regarding that?
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a curiosity about that. We know that when the Jewish people, after they had committed the sin with the golden calf, part of the tshuva, of course, was the rebuilding of the tabernacle. I mean, to build the tabernacle. And, you know, in the process of building the tabernacle, that was a sign of repentance, correct? That was part of their tshuva. They had to do that. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, so they completed the tabernacle, and Hashem filled the tabernacle with His glory. And now we take it a step further, and we say, and what you said was that every sin that is committed has some reminiscence of the golden calf, which makes sense. So I have two questions. One is then, was the tshuva not complete at that point when they completed the tabernacle? Was there some deficiency in that? That this would linger on from generation to generation? And then the second question I have is, every religion has a mystical element attached to it in some form or fashion.
Except Judaism.
My question is, say again, I'm sorry?
Except Judaism.
There's no mystical element to Judaism whatsoever?
None whatsoever.
So the idea of sod, what is sod then, and is that not mystical?
I don't know what you mean. What do you mean sod is?
Well, you know, the idea of the concept of partes. You know, the idea of peshat, the idea of remez, the idea of sod.
I don't know what your connotations of those words are. To me, they just have sod means a principle, remez means a hint, partes means a garden. I'm not sure.
Means a principle, you say? I'm sorry?
Yes, sod simply means principle. I'm not sure what definitions you were taught of those words. You have to educate me on that.
Okay. No, the idea of gematria, there's no mystical element to gematria.
Well, what do you define as mysticism?
Well, that's probably a good question.
Yeah.
For sure, but it, you know, I know the Hasidic, the maybe the Haredi, the Chabad next, I mean, don't they have a certain sense in which they indulge in certain mystical elements, or are they doing something different? I'm not saying that there's a negative connotation to certain mysticism. I'm not debating. I'm
right.
Certainly not, you know, arguing that.
Well, besides the negative connotation, I just have to understand first what your definition is. My understanding of mysticism is that there's inexplicable relationships between X and Y. If we have to boil down, I do this, it's not, and something I could, mix together some potion, and I pour it on the front stair of my house, and it's going to make my crippled uncle in Indiana walk upright. That to me is
mysticism. No, that's not what I'm referring to.
Okay, go ahead. Give me an example of mysticism.
Well, the notion, let's say, for instance, that every letter within the Torah has a significant, you know, if an aleph, a base, a dalet, a gimel, you know, this sort of thing. There is, in a sense, in gematria, that these characters, these letters, have certain meanings attached to them that go beyond, you know, peshat, that go beyond this quote-unquote literal meaning. That within the text, you know, there's something Hashem's trying to say to us that goes beyond what is the obvious.
Well, that sounds like a metaphor. A metaphor is what you just described.
Okay. So in that sense, I guess we're probably not understanding the whole notion of mysticism. I'm not saying that mysticism, you know, not like what the previous person said concerning tongues. You know, to me, that type of stuff borders on the occult. You know, I'm not saying that the mysticism is occultic, you know, within Judaism. But isn't there a sense in which a person or certain elements within Judaism, at least historically, have they not approached or tried to approach Hashem in a way that's different than what, you know, I mean, you're probably not following what I'm saying. I'm probably not making myself clear. But like,
I've heard things where they say that if you take certain letters and you can create things with it. Is that what you heard?
Well, there's in.
But that doesn't make sense because.
Let me ask you this: Do you believe Kabbalah to be mystical or not mystical?
I don't know what they understand Kabbalah to be, and there's a whole debate as to whether or not we have Kabbalah, first of all, the word just means to receive. So that means it's just transmissions. Now, are they from a great rabbi, or are they from this guy Moses de Leon? That's the whole debate. So the fact you have a debate on it, first of all, is a yellow flag. Second of all, to quote Rabbi Chait, an idea has to be sensible to be true. So it doesn't matter where we get it from. It could be a book called Kabbalah. It could be something else. If the idea is a sensible idea, it makes no sense who said it or where it's printed. If an idea makes no sense or has no intelligent meaning, so it has no meaning to us. And again, it doesn't matter where it's written or who said it. So to say that something is now Kabbalah, and by calling it part of Kabbalah, poof, this thing now is, you know, validated unconditionally, is wrong. We don't say it's unconditional validation because it's part of a book. The only thing we say that to is the five books of Moses. That's it. And prophets and writings. Those are the only things that have that elevated status. Those are divine. Now, everything else written by man. Man can make a mistake. So a book, you know, the Tanya, it's a big work by the first Lubavitch Rebbe. But in the book that they have today, there are ideas that are wrong. They say there's a piece of God in man. And it's a completely illiterate misreading of certain words in the book of Job. And it's clearly a wrong idea, but it's in the book. And you speak to any person who is of the Lubavitch movement, they would swear by the book up and down. Even if you showed them the idea was nonsense and heretical, which it is, they would have impossible for them to say that their Rebbe is wrong, because they are attached to the man Moses. The same sin that the Jews had at Sinai. They were about to get the Torah from God. Why do people think that today the Jews are any higher level? That my Rebbe is now infallible? No. Nobody is infallible, and that's a problem. And that's the same thing with the Kabbalah, too. Oh, it's written by some great rabbi, and therefore every single thing in this book now has to be true. Well, no. I mean, there's disputes among, you know, Maimonides and Nachmanides. In the very Torah we have, you know, it's funny, the same people today that will swear by their rabbi as being infallible, they'll open up a Torah today and they'll read it and they'll see that, you know, Maimonides says this, Rashi says something else. So they disputed. They didn't agree on everything. They disagreed on many things. So that shows you that no, you know, intelligent person is not going to say that man is infallible. And this thing about Kabbalah and all the other stuff, to me, it's just a bunch of nonsense. I mean, I've heard different things, and it doesn't make any sense. People don't even know what they're saying. It's like speaking in tongues. That sounds the same thing to me. They're saying things, at least with Kabbalah, that they're using English words when they're talking about it. But in speaking in tongues, it sounds like they're just mumbling. But what it boils down to is neither one is pronouncing any concept which is true and sensible. I mean, scientists and mathematicians.
The test, really, whether or not an idea is valid, is more or less has to do with the idea that it has to be mentally, it has to be attainable, has to be understood, and has to be able to be communicated clearly and logically so everybody can understand the idea.
It has to make sense, period.
It has to make sense.
It has to make sense. If somebody tells you an idea, I don't care if they told you President Bush said it. I don't care if they tell you that some rabbi said it. But it doesn't make a difference who said it. It doesn't matter if it's in print. But that's a big problem that people have. People respect books. People respect reputations. And that we really should be doing is respecting the idea. And that's where the shortcoming is.
Okay.
So, no. Mysticism, as understood, listen, we have a system. God showed us exactly how. There's planting cycles, and there's things that there are laws that govern certain areas of the crop and not planting things together, and all these different things that we have, and making tefillin and how to do slaughter animals are all based on natural scientific laws that we know to be true and consistent. So there's no hocus pocus going on. God does not endorse any of this type of a hocus pocus thing that things are. No, we can see how the world works, and the laws of the Torah endorse. Because we're told each year that we have to bring in the harvest thing at this time and give this amount to the priest and give this amount to the orphan and so on and so forth. But you can't talk about a harvest and all these different laws in the Torah unless there are regular, perceivable laws of what harvest is, what does grain mean, what does soil mean, all these things that God is speaking to man based in very clear, understandable, nouns and verbs and the adjectives, all these things are clear. And what people are doing is they're trying to reach for that over-religious emotion. That's why God put in the Torah, don't add on to the Torah. But people are doing it. And they're reaching for this Kabbalah, and they're reaching for stuff which they think is like a magical cure, a shortcut to spirituality. What makes me feel good? It's again, they won't do this with the syringe. So just keep that example. They're not going to do that when it comes to putting, you know, a real tangible change. If they go to a Kabbalah class, the rabbi in the Kabbalah class, you know, tells them, here's a syringe, everybody take one in your hand right now, and he says something which is equally as incomprehensible as his class from the previous week, but the previous week he didn't tell them to do anything, so they left the class going, he's a genius, he must have said something, you know, amazing, since I can't understand him, he's got to be a genius, you know? It's like a Jackie Mason routine. But the next week, if he says the same thing but now tells them to stick a syringe in their body, you'll see how fast they do it, because now they're not going to admit that he said anything sensible, because now they've got to put their life in the line.
Well, let me ask you this, Robert. One of the benefits, I'd hate to use the word benefit, but when Nadab and Abihu brought in the offering that was the one that Hashem did not command them to bring in, they were struck dead. So that all the people around them could see this was the consequence of this erroneous idea that you could simply just approach Hashem on any terms. Or the other example would be the other idea is that they were so exuberant in their worship of Hashem that they said, well, we have something in addition. In other words, we can add to this whole experience, and that, of course, is a danger as well. But they had the benefit before the whole community, and the whole community could see, wow, this is the consequence of these actions. We better not do that. Today, a person could do something like that, and the same result would not happen to them. I mean, in other words, there may be punishment, but it's going to be delayed in some form, you know, so there's not a real good checks and balances to make sure. You see what I'm saying? I mean, it's not visible to everybody that somebody is engaging in some of these.
Well, I don't know if that's true. If we had the temple today and two people walked in again, I don't see why God would react any differently.
Well, that's a point well made. You know, the point is we don't have a temple, so mm-hmm. How is that checks and balances? You know, I mean, I think I know what the answer is. You know, you follow the system the way the system was designed to be followed, and then, you know, I guess the point is, you know, the idea of blessings and cursings that the Torah comes out with is almost like it's immediate consequence. You know, if you do this, then this will result. If you don't do this, then this is going to be the result.
That's not necessarily true. Immediacy is not necessarily, every single, maybe even a majority of cases, the immediacy is not there. The guarantee that you'll have the punishment is there. Well, it says in the Shema that, you know, if you don't follow the gods, you'll be driven out from the land. When and where it's going to happen? I mean, it could even be that immediacy takes away free will. If a person, every single time he ate something which was not kosher, a lightning bolt hit him, he's never going to be able to use his free will, because it's the fear of the lightning bolt that is now going to deter him, and not intelligently understanding what is wrong with eating non-kosher.
No, that makes perfect sense. I didn't think of that angle. Thank you.
What was your angle?
You know, I didn't even think about the free will issue. You know, the notion that, you know, as free moral agents, you know, if there is a sense in which there's an immediate, punishment and immediate reward, then something else comes into play that, you know, when we make our decisions, you know, we're not really doing it out of a moral conviction.
Right.
You know, because how do we improve? And that's the point, you know, how do we improve in our character traits when we know immediately if somebody does something wrong, they immediately get struck down or they immediately get rewarded.
Yeah.
They'll begin to act upon the rewards and benefits in that fashion, right? Yeah, that whole learning issue and building your character and improving yourself would take on a whole different dimension. No, that makes sense.
Right.
Rabbi?
Yes, I'm just wondering, the time factor here, I know there's Rabbi Moskowitz because of class soon, doesn't he?
Rabbi, I have a correction to make, and I wanted to make an announcement that Rabbi Moskowitz had to cancel class this morning.
Okay.
It is possible we will get a notice from the conference call people, but we can keep going until then.
Okay, good. Somebody had a question just now?
Yes. Even after Aaron's sons were immediately struck down, there were still rebellions. So just having an immediate consequence isn't always a guarantee that people won't be stupid.
That's a good point. Yeah, the emotions are always there, constantly. They're with us until the day we die.
That's always a struggle between the emotions and the mind.
Yeah.
To do what's right or feel what's right.
Yeah. I did hear Robert Chait say on occasion that Moses was already at the point, though, where it wasn't like he had to choose the right life anymore. He already saw the right life. So it was now a natural involvement. And that's something which evidently is attainable. We can reach the point where we have learned so much and we start seeing clearly and we've worked on our emotions of rebelliousness and we've reached a certain point where it does start to become natural and it's not a struggle anymore. And that makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, no, that's true.
I mean, a person knows he has to pay for his rent. He doesn't ever, you know, rebel against, you know, going to work. That's a clear, you know, the survival instinct. So that can be applied in every other area, but that's going to be based on intelligent comprehension. That's what I'm saying. There's no mysticism in Judaism. It's something which completely adopted from other cultures. And Jews are always worried about, you know, being apologetic and being recognized by everybody else. And unfortunately, that's why you have, you know, people in the religious circles now, they are accepting to have interfaith dialogue to show how accepting we are of Baptists and ministers and priests. Yes, we can let them come into our study halls and talk with our yeshiva students. It's the worst thing. You're basically sending a message to them that we recognize you just as much as we recognize the Torah. It's the worst thing that you can do because you're misleading them. And you're not supposed to be abrasive, but you have to be honest. This is something which is idolatrous, and we don't recognize what you have to say because it's like talking to a voodoo doll or a totem pole. I mean, it's pure idolatry, and that's something which unfortunately is the Jew is cowering, and that, you know, being honest and respectful and to himself and to the system and to what he's supposed to be doing is to be perpetuating the Torah, not trying to get, you know, accolades for himself.
But Rabbi, is it the Orthodox Jews who are doing this, or the non-Orthodox Jews? All the time when I hear about dialogues here in the Seattle area between the Jewish community and the non-Jewish community, it's never the Orthodox, it's the Reform or whatever. And which brings up the question, you know, how on track are they?
Well, they're completely off track. That's the whole point. And they're no longer Orthodox, in my opinion. They're violating the most fundamental of Orthodox principles.
Yeah, when you hear about Sarah, Rabbi Sarah, talking to them.
Yeah, right.
Makes you wonder.
Yeah. Well, you know, female leadership is no problem. You had the Devorah, who was a judge, in, you know, in Jewish history. You had Esther, who saved the day in Purim. So that's not a problem. The problem is, you know, recognizing and trying to be apologetic. But that's all personal. They're getting too much into being, you know, I have to be nice to them, and I have to, you know, verbally recognize. But that's the danger. They really should be nice. But they should say clearly that your ideas are wrong for X, Y, and Z reasons. That's all. All right. I just want to also mention, just getting back, I glossed over it, this concept that we talked about, not going into the Holy of Holies, and to show that there is a separation between us and God. So when that one day came of Yom Kippur that the high priest would bring in the incense, he was now showing that on that one day, Yom Kippur, his going into the room demonstrates that there was a tolerance for their for man to get a little bit closer to God on that day. That's what it means, that he's going into the Holy of Holies that one day. But even when he goes in, he has to smoke up the room. The whole, the what the offering was in that Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur was to smoke up the room, for the precise reason that when he's in there, he still has to have a veil. So that's what the smoke is. So it's, he goes in on Yom Kippur and he admits the veil by creating that smoke, and there's an atonement, because if we recognize this primary concept on Yom Kippur, that's what can give us atonement. The atonement will come from recognizing. Now, I was speaking to a relative last night. He was not observant, and I thought of something to tell him, because he's not, you know, financially, it's very tight for him right now. And I tried to tell him, if you live properly, and you know, God has many ways to assist a person. It's a small thing for you. God can make Jupiter and Saturn and galaxies with billions of stars. He can give you a few extra dollars. But you have to be deserving. But I was thinking to myself, even that concept itself would raise him to a higher level if he could admit that he doesn't have to just live his life based on mathematics. Meaning, I have X amount right now, and that's all I've got. If he could admit that God can step in, that itself raises him to a higher level, and he'll be under God's providence even more, just by admitting that idea. So maybe that's the same concept here, that when the priest goes in and he admits the veil that exists between the Jews and God, that smoke, that's something which has an atoning, it has an atoning quality. Because when we raise ourselves to a new awareness and conviction of a true idea, that's something which is an important idea. That's something which can atone. My good friend Shmuel Moskowitz once gave a good idea. Why is it that the new month, it says that it's a time of atonement for everything that you... All your creation. What does it mean, a time of atonement, new month? And the rabbis speak about the idea of why does the moon wax and wane? And in the actual prayer that we say every month, and you should read through it, the Kiddush Levana, it's just one paragraph, but it says that it is a glorious crown to those born of the womb, because they will eventually become renewed just like the moon. So when we see the moon, now it's a new month, and now the moon is going from being completely... invisible, now we see a crescent, right? We see the C-shaped crescent, and then it starts growing and growing until it's a full moon. So that is to be a sign to man that we can also, even though we sin, we can wax again to be full, just like a full moon. So that idea itself, that we sin but we can repent, is something which is an atonement. Meaning the very concept that we can become better is something which opens the doors to our becoming better. That if I have an image of myself that I'm a failure and I can never improve, I'm not going to make any steps to improve. But if I can accept with conviction that just as the moon is small and gets bigger, I can also work on myself. So that recognition that I can work on myself is something which God now says, I'm going to forgive you for your sins, because you're basically saying, I'm not the same person I was yesterday. And since I'm not carrying that repeated behavior, that identity that I had yesterday, a person who sins, and I'm saying, I don't have to be that way. So now that I've shed that identity of myself, that opens the door for me to now improve. And that is something which God atones. And the Talmud actually says that a number of people are forgiven for their sins. One of them is a person who is elevated in rank, let's say in the army. Another one is a person who gets married. Now, why is a person who's elevated in rank and gets married, is now atoned for their sins? It's this very idea, because they have shed a previous identity of themselves, and now they no longer look at themselves as that old person. Now it's a new state in life. That very view, that very self-image that a person has, that now I'm entering I have entered a new state in my life. So now, since I look at myself as a new type of person, that psychologically causes me to detach from the patterns of behavior I had in the past. So now God doesn't punish you anymore, because you've now changed. A change took place in you, even if it was an external change, that somebody promoted you. That itself causes you to shed the attachment to the previous self-identity, and now you're not going to follow the same patterns of behavior. So therefore, God doesn't judge you the same anymore. It's a nice idea. All right.
Very nice.
Yeah, nice idea. So, yeah, but I feel that just to wrap it up, we have, it's, you know, the temple does give us primary ideas that we can't approach God directly. We have no real positive knowledge, and we cannot know what He is, but we can know that He's creator. That's the menorah. We can know that He's all-powerful, and He can sustain all generations. That's the 12 loaves of bread for the 12 tribes. And we can know that He's omniscient, that He's all-knowing. And that instills in us the concept that the reward and punishment, and He recognizes our actions. And everything else is really subsumed under those. So it really works out nice in terms of what the one of the explanations of the temple is. It really targets a lot of very, very important fundamentals. Providence.
Excuse me, Rabbi. Can I ask a question on a resource?
Yeah, go ahead.
Can you recommend a book on the temple and one that presents the ideas that you're relating on a deeper level? Is there a book that a person can purchase that goes through and describes these things?
I don't know. I never did any research on that. You know, the best book really is the we have it. We have Exodus, and it's just, you know, it's something which takes time to unravel, because that's really where all the, you know, God's clear hints as to what this is all about are there. So it's a study process. So the best book is really going to the source. Since you use the word source, that is the source. But I never really researched other books on the temple to tell you to have any. This is something I worked on just based on the commentaries.
Well, that's what I'm asking. Is there one particular commentary you would recommend?
Not one, a number. It's always, you know, Maimonides talks about it a bit in the Guide for the Perplexed. He also talks about in the Mishneh Torah. The section of the Mishneh Torah is called the Laws of the Selected House. We did some of that last week. There are a number of articles on the site, on the Masorah site, that you can use. Just do a search for temple. And so a lot of the legwork will be done. Rashi, you could take a look at. Ibn Ezra, I think somebody once told me that they saw Maimonides' quote. He said that Ibn Ezra was like the best commentator on the Torah. And I believe now there is an English Ibn Ezra available.
Ibn Ezra.
Yeah, Ibn Ezra.
Nachmanides.
Nachmanides too, right? His works in English have been around for a long time. Those would be the top ones. You know, Sforno also. That's by Rabbi Pelkovitz. P-E-L-C-O-V-I-T-Z. Pelkovitz.
Are these available through Art Scroll?
Not sure Art Scroll has it. The Sforno is by Art Scroll, yes. Ibn Ezra, I never saw the book. So I can't comment on that. What's that?
Is that Feldheim or Art Scroll might have those available?
Yeah, you can check through them.
Okay. Thank you.
Right.
Rabbi?
Yes.
You know in the temple when they talk about the linens and they say sky blue, dark red, crimson?
Yes.
Sky blue, dark red, and crimson wool and twined linen?
If the colors have any significance?
I thought they did. I wrote something, I think it's probably in Numbers somewhere. I think right in the beginning. I wrote an article, it's called The Vessel's Coverings. And there, when they disassembled the temple and they carried all the vessels out, so they had coverings on them. Interesting, I think they had colored coverings and then an animal skin. So the animal skin was to protect it from the elements, just like the animal skin on the temple was the outermost covering to protect it from the precipitation. So when they dissembled the temple and they carried it, so they would put over them different colored garments first, and then on top of those colored garments, either blue or red, they would put an animal skin. But it was reverse when they did it with the ark. The ark, I believe, had the animal skin on first and then a blue covering. And I think because the ark was the blue, I've heard different commentators, or at least one, that the blue represents the sky, and when you look to the sky, it reminds you of creation because of all the stars and then the blue hue of the sky. And but the ark being the primary object that everything else is really targeting, so that's not something which we're covering, that it needs to be taken care of, so to speak, with a animal skin to cover from precipitation. We want that purpose to always be seen, so we put the blue on the outside, whereas all the other vessels had the animal skin on the outside, because they really had no function when they were not in the temple. And I think there was a very interesting idea there. And I think actually the red was on one of the altars, and red perhaps means blood. That's what you'd identify red with. So it could be it signifies, you know, a certain concept. I can't say with 100% surety. But an interesting idea, now that you brought it up, is that the even when they carried them, there were laws about how do you carry them, what color, what goes on the outside. So in terms of when the temple was not assembled, so then the various vessels didn't really have the right, they had definition based on the juxtaposition to the ark. Right? You understand, because when you have two rooms, and one is right before the other room, and you can't go into that room, but you can go into this room. So then the temple has meeting, and all the vessels have meeting, but only when they're put into this framework of the temple. If you take it out the menorah and just put it out in the middle of the street, it doesn't give you that concept that it's in part of the whole structure, the whole framework of temple. You follow? Like if you'd see a human vein on an operation table, and that was the first time you ever saw a human vein, you wouldn't know what the purpose of that vein is. But when you see the human vein in the body, now you understand exactly what the purpose of the vein is for. So the same thing with the other vessels. So that's why when they were being carried from location to location in the wilderness for 40 years, you covered them with the animal skin. It was just protecting them. They're just in transit, and now there's really no use. But the ark, they didn't do that. The ark had to still have the blue on the outside to show you that the ark is really the objective, and it doesn't find its purpose when it's in the structure of the temple. And I'll give you a proof, because the ark itself is to represent the concept that we can't approach God and directly. And we talked at the very beginning about the poles were never allowed to be removed from the ark. Now, why is that? See, when you took the other vessels and you put them in the temple and then you removed the poles, that means it now found its resting place. It now found its objective when it was in the temple, right? It was part of the structure. Make sense so far?
Yes.
Okay. However, if we don't take the poles out of the ark, because the ark doesn't find any more understanding when it's in the temple than when it's not. So we keep the poles in the ark to show that the ark did not arrive now at its destination, because the temple is not the destination of the ark. The ark is really the primary object. The temple is there for the ark. But if I take the ark and I put it in the Holy of Holies and I remove the poles, I'm saying that now I found the resting place for the ark. Now I found the ark is now finding a higher fulfillment of its lesson. But that's not true. It's not finding anything more in this place. Perhaps to show you that that place is not something that you can identify with God. So we leave the poles inside the ark to show that it's no more finding its definition over here in this place or that place. God is unapproachable. If we'd say that the ark is finding it's reaching a higher goal now that it's in the temple, so we're basically saying that location is something which is applicable to the ark. But that's not true, because the ark is really to teach us that we can't approach God. There's no, and that includes that location has nothing to do with God. So maybe also that's why when they were carrying the ark, so it was no less. Again, you had to do it with honor, so you had to cover it. And you didn't want it to get damaged by the dust and by the gold. So you put the animal skin on it, but you put the blue on the outside of it to still remind you of the truth. I mean, you should look at something here with the ark. It had to be covered, but at the same time, it's not going to be covered with an animal skin on the outside of the other vessels, because the other vessels don't find any definition. There's no lesson until they're assembled in the temple. But the ark itself is not dependent upon temple.
So, Rabbi, let me ask you a question. What's your opinion of the efforts that are being made today by different groups to try to locate the ark? In other words, they're trying to, they think it's at the bottom of the temple and all of this sort of thing. And I always find it curious that whenever they're talking about trying to find the ark, they never mention the tablets that are in the ark. In other words, the focus is never upon, you know, the Torah or the law. It's just upon the box.
And yeah, that's a good point.
For.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if there's anything wrong with them looking for it, but you're right. You just mentioned it's a good point. That they're enamored by the golden figurines and the whole, Hollywood probably has alerted them to this whole thing. It's very recent, isn't it? They haven't been doing this for a long time. I mean, this is like a recent last 10, 20 years?
Correct. It's a while.
Well, that's when that movie came out. About in search of the Ark of the Covenant. That was about 20 years ago. So that you know, woke them up. And powers, you know, it's the whole mystical thing going on there again. But you're right. And that's why the Ark was designed in a way that the two cherubs on the top were looking down. They were facing down. As if to say, we're concerned about what's in the Ark. Don't look at us. We're not the focal point here.
Yeah.
What they were concerned, what they were looking at was what's inside the Ark, the law, the ideas.
Rabbi?
Yes?
I had read that part of the reason, one of the reasons for the poles being left in was to symbolize that the Torah will go with the Jews no matter where they go. As they get scattered, that the Torah goes with them.
That makes sense. That makes sense. But
Rabbi? But
interesting is when Moses had assembled the temple the first time, the order was that you'd think that he'd put the poles in last, but he didn't. He put the poles in like toward the beginning of the structure to sort of hint that they're essential. So I would think that this would be something more than just what you're saying, that it's just like, you know, a nice idea that the Torah will go with you, but some definition about the item itself has to be demonstrated by the pole, since they were given prominence. And on top of that, when Solomon made the temple, it said that he put the wings of the cherubim, the cherubs, were covering the ark and its poles. It's like if poles are just merely a device for transport, you wouldn't want to just, you know, you wouldn't give such prominence to the poles. But it says in the verse over there that the cherubs had their wings spread out, covering the ark and its poles. I mean, the poles are part of the definition of the ark. This thing is not finding any higher purpose now that it's in the temple or not. The poles stay in here. The poles are staying. It's not. It's still ready. And the converse is true. Why did the priests go around barefoot in the temple? And why did God tell Moses to take his shoes off at the burning bush? Because shoes are used for transport. But when you are in the location that is the best location to be, you take off your shoes to show you that there's no intent to leave. So that's why the priests didn't wear shoes, just to show that now they were in the most fundamental activity of the central activity of their life was temple worship. So you take off your shoes. I'm not going anywhere. I have no interest to travel at this point. And the same thing with Moses. So it's the flip side of the poles.
Oh.
Yes. Somebody had a question?
Yeah. One of the commandments is not to mix wool and linen. And yet, in the construction of the tabernacle, they are commanded to mix wool and linen.
Yes.
Any thoughts about why that is?
Yeah, that also applies to tzitzis. Meaning to say, Rabbi Chait once gave a beautiful class on shatnez. You're talking about the law of shatnez, which means not to mix wool and linen. And this is not just limited to garments, but you cannot work two animals together of different species. You can't plant two different types of vegetation too close together because they may interbreed. You know, crossbreeding animals is a problem why you can't work the two animals together. And not mixing clothing. So, and it's also wool and linen. Wool is a plant life. Excuse me, wool comes from animal. And linen is plant life, right? So, Rabbi Chait explained, quoting Ibn Ezra, he says, this is now to recall, not mixing these two things, wool and linen, is to recall not to mix the two things that are planted in the heart. And that's the emotions and the intellect. So he says the whole principle behind not mixing, and you have this in many areas, different areas when you're working your animals, when you're planting, when you're wearing your clothes, there's different areas of your life that it covers in order that you're constantly reminded to be on guard, not to mix two things that are in your heart, meaning your intelligence and your emotions should not become intermingled. You should be guiding your life purely by intelligence. So that was Rabbi Chait's explanation of the Ibn Ezra. I wanted to add that why wool and linen? Because those represent the only two things that can have crossbreeding. Excuse me. The only two things that can have crossbreeding. Because those are the only things that have growth attached to it, is either animal life or plant life. But elements, you can't crossbreed silver and iron, right? Or a rock and water, right? Elements cannot be crossbred. So you have two representations of those areas that can be crossbred. So that's wool and linen. And maybe because they also are very productive in terms of clothing, they're also selected. Because you could say, well, you could say don't mix the horn of an animal with something else, but that's just not practically how it's done. So perhaps God's wisdom dictated that which humans would be inclined to mix just because of practical needs of clothing, so he said there, don't mix. Just to give you the concept, these are the two areas that can create mixed breeds. And it would call back to the idea, and by doing this and being on guard to not mixing, God knows our psyche very well. And he knows that if we are on guard not to mix these things in different areas of our life, it conditions us to keep this type of a sanctified state of mind where we are on guard in other areas not to mix. Meaning once you condition the human being in the thinking pattern of not mixing in a number of different areas, so then when it comes to living his life and choosing and making decisions, he's going to feel a tinge of that when he's making decisions in life, and he'll sense the mixing of the emotions and the intellect, and he'll be more conditioned now to hold back and not to mix in that area. So now, why is it that in the temple they could mix? And it would suggest that you can mix. See now, since these are the very laws that God commanded you to do, so now your emotions are already protected. So now there's no danger to mix in this area because you're actually involved in God's word. So now since you're following God's word, there's no danger that you're going to deviate, or less of a danger, however you want to put it. So then the intermixing laws are not necessary. That's my answer.
Thank you, Rabbi. That helped.
That law was ahead of its time. Now we're genetically intermixing plants and animals.
Really?
Yes.
How do you do that? You're mixing do you mean that you're mixing animals with plants, or we're mixing animals with animals and plants with plants?
No. Animal genes with plants.
So we... you can grow horses on trees?
For research, yes, they'll put in, let's say, a certain gene in a plant. They'll grow that plant, and then they'll extract out those genes or whatever it is from the plants. And that is a very common process in a lot of the biology research these days.
Well, then
also
maybe
in growing plants, that's where some of the big concerns come these days with frankenfoods. But there's a lot of they're not required to let us know what foods are genetically engineered, and in fact, almost all the corn that you'll find in the stores are genetically engineered.
Well, there's two thoughts come to mind. First of all, there may not be a problem to intermingle animal with plant. As far as I know, it's just certain plants with other plants and certain animals with certain animals. So that might not be a problem, interestingly enough. Second of all, the mixing process, even plant with plant, may only be in the phenomena of agricultural activities, but on the chemical or molecular level, again, that might not be falling into what the actual prohibition is. So we have to look at the Torah to see, you know, when is it prohibited in terms of plants with plants, and is there any prohibition at all to intermingle a plant with an animal? There may not be at all. We have to look into that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know there's a lot of emotions involved in this, and also fear of what some of the consequences might be.
Yeah. Well, listen, we have the Torah system. We'll consult the verses and the Shulchan Aruch, and we'll determine it that way. But, you know, it shouldn't be any more of a emotionally riveted area.
Well, they can clone cows now,
right?
And theoretically, they could clone people.
Right, that's nice to know. You get more like-minded people in your neighborhood next year.
Yeah. There's only one problem with it is that when they do the cloning, like for the cows, to get one good cow, you'll end up having to destroy five or six that don't come out right. So I guess if you're willing to clone your neighbor and you get five of them that aren't too good, you take them out back and you clobber them on the head to keep the one good one.
Right. Sounds like you got a good beginning for a movie over there.
Yeah.
Yes, Cal, you had a question?
Oh, that's how they do it.
Cal, you had a question?
Well, it's not so much of a question. It's something that kind of an analogy that I saw in what you were saying back when we were talking of taking the menorah out of the temple or the vein on the table when you take it out of the context. I was even thinking in regards to our speech or the written, something written, when you take it out of context, it no longer has the meaning.
Yeah, exactly. We have to see exactly where it's couched to see. I always do that when I see a verse. I like to know, you know, get a real sense of what the area is talking about. Instead of just reading a verse, you can definitely, you know, and even the verses that they, like I was talking earlier, where they say there's a piece of God in every human being, so they took a few words out of a whole sentence, and that's how they came up with that corruption. Because the whole sentence says, what portion would I have with God? So they just take the words, portion with God, or portion of God. And they say, oh, you see, you can have a portion of God. So it's a complete, you know, illiterate reading. And, you know, to your point.
Oh.
All right. All right, so maybe we'll wrap it up here for today. I guess touch base during the week. There is another angle to the temple. We could go a little bit further if you'd like next week, which is also very interesting. A whole different angle. So maybe we'll do that next week.
I think that would be very interesting. Obviously,
yeah, that's very interesting.
Resulted in much discussion.
Good. Very good. All right, so we'll do that. So we'll continue with the theme next week.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Rabbi.
My pleasure.
Bye.
Okay, have a good week to everybody.
Anyway, you too, Rabbi.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, bye-bye. My pleasure. Thank you.